The world seems so unstable, so insecure. Everything is changing way too fast. But there are some things that are steadfast, things that never change. God and His Word. Join us as Pastor Randy Rehm shares truths from God's unchanging Word.
So we're in John chapter 6, starting in verse 1. When you're there, please stand. It is our tradition to stand at the reading of God's Word. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or also known Tiberias, Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd followed him because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Jesus went up on the mountain when he sat down with his disciples. Now it was Passover, that is, the feast of the Jews, was near. Therefore, Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing the crowd was coming to him, he said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?" This was, he was saying, to test them, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. And Philip answered, said, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone even to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are these for so many people?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed it to those who were seated. Likewise also the fish, as much as they wanted, and they were filled. And he said to his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, so nothing will be lost." So they gathered up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments from the barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, "This is truly the prophet who was to come into the world." So Jesus, perceiving that they were intended to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew to the mountain by himself alone. You may be seated. Now, we realize again that this event, this miracle, is in all 4 Gospels. There are details that John does not give because John has a particular, I'll say, agenda. He's given the details that are relative to what he's trying to do. And remember, Jesus is trying to show that, or John is trying to show that Jesus is the Son of God who takes away the sins of the world. You can read in the last chapter John describes. That's his purpose in writing the book. And he gives, in particular, 7 miracles to prove that point. He doesn't do them all. Matter of fact, you get to the last chapter of John and he says, "Man, Jesus did so many things, if we wrote them all down, it'd fill all the books." So he's saying, "I didn't put all the details in there." And so when we look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we pick up other parts of the details. So you might have gone, "Wait a minute, I don't remember it quite like that," because you typically hear it taught out of Matthew or Mark. Luke actually gives the least amount of details. Now, it follows a pattern here, just like it did in chapter 5 when Jesus heals the fellow at the pool of Bethesda. And there's a lame man there. He tells him to get up, walk. Remember that. He gives a long discourse, particularly about he and the Father being one, the equality between the Father and the Son. Okay, that makes the people angry. They want to kill him. All right, you'll see this similar pattern here. Now, when Jesus gives that discourse, he gives witnesses to prove that he is the Son of God. He starts with John the Baptist. He talks about his Father's witness at the baptism. The works he's doing, and he emphasizes that the works the Father does, I do, and I only do what the Father tells me to do. And he also says, but if you don't get that, to you should be the witness of Moses. If you didn't believe that Moses wrote about me, you're just lost in the whole picture. Now that's important because the text tells us it's about Passover time. Okay, so that tells us that Moses, Passover, bread, wine, and the Exodus and the time in the wilderness, including the manna that comes down from heaven, is on their mind. Matter of fact, Jesus refers to that later in the chapter and says he's the bread that came down to heaven. Okay, so we don't want to disconnect how he ends chapter 5 and starts chapter 6. But we do have a change in location. He's moved from that Jerusalem area to Capernaum. Jesus has actually moved from Nazareth to Capernaum, by the way. That's in Matthew 4. And so he's in Capernaum, and they've spent a whole bunch of time ministering. So Jesus wants to get away to a secluded place, sort of to debrief with the disciples and get some rest. So this whole episode, where he was in Nazareth, where they rejected his ministry in Nazareth, has taken place. The Bible says he's traveled to various villages. So if we looked at a map of... I should have did it, because some of you may not have this picture in your head, but as Israel, when you head up towards Syria, I guess, follow the Jordan up from the Dead Sea, you get to the Sea of Galilee, okay, or the Sea of Tiberias, it's called, because John is writing late into that first century, and by the city of Tiberias, named after Caesar, okay, so the Roman name comes to take over. Remember, we realize that John's writing to people that aren't necessarily Jewish in Jerusalem. Okay, so he's the one who explains these Jewish words and Jewish names, realizing that his audience. So he uses that Roman name for those, Sea of Galilee, where's that? Oh, excuse me, Sea of Tiberias. That gives them an idea where it's at. Okay, he's traveled to these, on that side of the sea, the lake, okay, on the what we would say is the western side, there are several cities. Gennesaret, Capernaum, Nazareth isn't far from there, Tiberias, that's the populated side. On the east side is, even to this day, is the unpopulated side. Bethsaida is up sort of the top northwest corner. There's actually national parks there. Because as the Jordan River comes in this way and other tributaries come in, it's very green and lush. There's a lookout up here on this high hill that would overlook where they believe this took place. I mean, it's very high. You can see all the whole lake, and you can look the other way. You can go online and look at pictures of that. Okay? Jesus has received the news that John the Baptist has been beheaded. So that he had sent his disciples in pairs to go out and preach. Now, don't think of this as just the 12 disciples, because we find out in the chapter there's a whole bunch of others, and some of them leave him because of this hard message that he says. But Mark 6 puts it this way, in Mark 6, 30 through 32. The apostles gathered together with Jesus, and they reported to him all that they had done and taught. And he, Jesus, said to them, come away by ourselves to a secluded place and rest for a little while. For there had been many people coming to him, okay? And they did not have, they, the disciples, nor the people would have time to eat. And they went away in a boat to a secluded place by themselves. So that preempts the Mark story. They left Capernaum by boat, okay? And if you go by boat or you walk, walking's only about a mile further. So why'd he go by boat? To get secluded. You can't fit a whole bunch of other people in the boat with you. Okay? Now we do find out from the stories that many of these people, some of them actually run by land, others by boat. All right? So that's why we say, after these things, what things? All those things that I just explained to you, they get away to the other side. Now, I also, you know, I think, I'm not sure what size Lake Payette is up there. I have no idea. But, you know, this lake, though, is 700 feet below sea level. That's the shoreline. Because you're all heading, it's all heading to, as the Jordan heads down southward, eventually gets to the Dead Sea, the lowest point on earth, where Sodom and Gomorrah used to be. And when God pounds you into the ground, he pounds you into the ground. Okay, so it's the lowest point on earth. So as it's flowing down, even the Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. It's 13 miles long, north to south, and its widest point is about 7 miles across. That's not how far Jesus would be traveling both, because as the lake shaped sort of like this, they're going across this, and there was this triangle, if you will, that where Jesus ministered most of his Galilean ministry. Now it says a large crowd followed him. recognize when he's on the west side of the lake, all the people coming down from the north along the Jordan have to go around the lake to get to Jerusalem for Passover. Okay, so this is one of the reasons it tells us why it's Passover. Why is there such a big crowd? You got all these people traveling, not just the people that lived in the towns there. Okay, it is spring. It tells me that when it's Passover, which for us is right around Easter. Our Easter always coincides with the Jewish Passover. So it's spring. When he says there's green grass, we have all seen pictures of Palestine in the summer, right? It's sort of like if you look up at the foothills right now, they're very green. They won't be in another month. So one of the reasons we know as Passover, and one of the reasons the grass is green, which all the Gospels talk about that grass, okay, is green is because it is spring. It's around Passover. It's given us that time frame, all right? And the idea that the whole idea of the Exodus and Moses and all that stuff is on their mind. That's why they're going to Jerusalem to do that celebration. So on this side of the lake with the people, as Jesus crosses over to the other side of the lake, the eastern side, people want to follow. Because remember, he's been ministering over here. He's been healing sick. He's been doing these things. And it tells us that, Mark tells us that they left in such a hurry, both the disciples and the people didn't take anything to eat. What's the purpose of unleavened bread at Passover? So for the Jewish people, the quickness in which they had to leave. Okay, so this idea of leaving in a hurry fits with the Passover motif. Okay, now Jesus goes to the other side and he wants to go up on the mountain, which was he typically would go up into a high place to pray and to be alone. That particular part, like I said, is could be very green, very wooded. I know we tend to think of Palestine as just desert, but because you're around the sea, okay, and around those tributaries coming in, it's quite green there. And you can go Google map it and see a satellite image if you want. There's a bunch of farms down below these hills now. There's a Byzantine church on the site, which actually they found a mosaic with the fish in the basket. So at least we know the Byzantines thought that was the place. All right, and that's 5 to 6 miles from Bethsaida, around there. Okay, so he goes up on this mountain. We call this area the Golan Heights. That's what we would call it today, the Six-Day War, right? People were shooting down at Israel from the Golan Heights, so Israel says, we got to stop that, and that's why Israel took the Golan Heights. That's the area that we call it today, okay? Jesus sees all these people. It says, Jesus went up and sat down with his disciples. And lifting up his eyes, he sees the large crowd. Well, in Mark, it says he had compassion upon them. He sees this crowd because they look like sheep without a shepherd in a grassy field or hillside. It makes sense, right? That imagery, okay, that he spent the day teaching them, okay, about the things of the kingdom of God and healing the sick. You can see that in the other accounts, okay? So you say, how do you teach to that many people? Okay, well, for one, you're up a hillside on a lake. Now, my in-laws have a cabin on a lake, and we'll go up there at summertime. You can hear people talking on the other side of the lake because, you know, how stuff carries on. Now you put them up on a hill and amplify that in a little bit of an amphitheater-type thing. But just to give you an idea, I don't know if you know this, but Benjamin Franklin wrote an autobiography. In it, he writes of his good friend, the Reverend George Whitefield, the greatest preacher of what's called the Great Awakening in the United States. Okay? Talks much about him. They were friends. But he's in Philadelphia and realizes how many people are listening to Whitefield at a moment. So he walks the streets of Philadelphia, starting on Market Street. You can read it in the autobiography. It's old. You can get it through the Library of Congress. You can get it as a PDF, or you can buy the book. Okay? And in the particular book, the version that I have, electronic, that's on page 135. He talks about George Whitefield being able to speak to 25,000 people at a time without amplification. Okay? That's in Philadelphia. Imagine over a lake, up on a hillside. So it's not far-fetched, unless Ben was a liar. But he was trying to verify Benjamin Franklin was the reports he saw in the newspapers. Could that many people really hear? And part of it, he talks about the wise voice being loud and the crowd was always respectful and quiet. What an idea. Anyway, but our story here says, where it looks like Jesus looks to Philip and goes, hey, where can we buy bread for these people to eat? All right, but the other gospel tells it's actually the disciples that broach the subject first or breach the subject first. They come up and say, hey, it's getting dinner time. It's evening. Dismiss the crowd so they can go out to the villages surrounding areas and find some food. Now, again, if they were going to go to Bethsaida, that's a 5 to 6 mile walk. That's an hour and a half to 2 hour walk. It's getting dark. If that's the town, they're going, why did he ask Philip? Anybody want to guess? Because we learn in verse or chapter 1, Philip's from Bethsaida. He's from the region. Well, why would we dismiss these people? And then, hey, Phil, where would they go around here to eat? It's no different than when you visit family or relatives. Where's a good place to eat around here? He's asking the guy from there. Okay? You think the Bible tells us this name just because he wanted. He wants to recognize Philip's from that region. Philip is the one who recruited Nathanael, and he said this, and I'm doing this on purpose because it links with the text, okay? When he said to Nathanael, he says, see, we have found him whom Moses wrote. It's Passover, who's on everybody's mind, okay? Whom Moses wrote in the law, and the prophets wrote also, Jesus, the son of Joseph, from Nazareth. So Jesus himself draws on this Moses thing even later in the chapter. But it says that Jesus says to them, well, where could we buy him something to eat? It tells us that Jesus is saying this to test them, that Jesus knew what he was going to do. Jesus was not asking Philip really for information. Because they've already said, and you see it in the other, what do you mean? We're in a desolate place. They're in a McDonald's here, man. This is a small town, Jesus. You're lucky if there's a sandwich shop around the corner. Okay, so Jesus knows there's not a lot of places, but he's testing them. Why? Okay, well, I think part of it does is it also sets expectation for the reader. Jesus knew what he was intending to do. Oh, really? What's he intending to do? And those of us who know the story, yeah, we're looking forward to seeing what he's going to do. I mean, that's just a literary device, okay? But later he's going to actually tell the disciples to do a particular thing to test their faith. They fail, and he actually says to them, oh, you a little faith. You'll see that as we move down the chapter. So he's literally going to test the 12 in particular as he moves on. But even later, when they get back across to Capernaum, all right, he's going to tell them something they don't like. And he's going to see how many hang, how many stay with them. And I'll be honest, a bunch abandon him. And this is the first time in John where he refers to the 12, saying a whole bunch of others left, but there were 12 that stayed. And that would include Judas Iscariot. Okay? So this that he knew he was going to do and to test them, don't put it just in the context of this story. Jesus does this through the rest of the chapter. Philip's response, man, 6-7 months worth of wages ain't going to buy these people food. I mean, even if you did, they would get a little. Right, that's my paraphrase. He says, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone would receive a little. Okay, a denarii is about a day's wages. Okay, you can get that from Scripture and various other. Those who are here on Wednesday nights, you can look it up on the BDAG on page 223. And the rest of you go, say what? BDAG is a lexicon of Greek language, not just in the Bible, beyond that, and in particular, the BDAG's the initials of these guys who edited it from the original guy who wrote it in German, blah, 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 blah. Okay? But those of you that come on Wednesday hear that, a reference to that often. Okay? So I could just take a day, 200 denarii, a day's wage, figuring you work 6 days a week, Jewish, they don't work on one. I got 7 to 7.5 months. Okay, it's not hard to figure that. If you worked for half a year, that'd be just enough to give everybody a little. And the reason I think that's important is this, and it's later when he says they were filled, is because some people who want to wash away the miracles of Jesus' ministry is saying, well, everybody, they shared the food and everybody was polite and took a little, you know, and everybody got a little. Well, it'd be really little, but even 200 denarii worth of bread would get everybody a little, right? I think the point here in the story is they're pointing out the impossibility of this. There's no way we're going to feed 20 to 25,000 people. But I think it's pointing out that this is just an impossibility, and I think he does that even more so as he goes on, okay? And we learn that the reason they know there's these loaves and fishes is Jesus actually sends them out into the crowd to find out, well, how much food is in the crowd? We've already been told in one of the other Gospels, they left without bringing anything with them. Okay? And so they got there and they find this young lad. Again, and some guys that are way smarter than me, that word lad can be a young slave. It doesn't necessarily have to be male. And I let the scholars who are the experts in Greek debate that one. Now he has 5 barley loaves. Now I think this is the only one of the Gospels that tells us it's barley. And if you read non-biblical, I'll call it secular Greek at the time, you can run across some things where somebody talks about barley loaves and the response of the other recipient is, well, just give it to the horses. Because barley, you ever ate barley bread? That ain't white flour, white bread. That ain't Wonder Bread, folks. Barley bread's the low-end bread. You know, my wife eats that bread with nuts and twigs and sticks and things in it. You know what I mean? But that's barley bread. Okay? It's not like you're gonna smoosh it and roll it in a nice soft ball. Okay? Then he has these fish, and you heard me tell the kids there's no refrigeration. It's been all day. It's probably either a pickled or a dried fish. That's probably what we're looking at. And they're not big old loaves of bread like we think. Some argue that the word actually means cracker. And I'm not, again, not a good an expert enough anyway to determine that. But it also tells you this. How were the disciples and Jesus going to eat? They didn't even have anything with them. So they go find this lad's lunch or dinner, okay? And verse 10 tells us, Jesus said, have them sit down. Now, the other Gospels tell us that he had them sit down in groups of 50 and 100 according to the men. All right? So how do you know there was about 5,000 men? Because we put them in groups of 50 and hundreds and we can just count groups. Do you see what I'm saying? You don't have to count every person, just groups. All right? And according to the men, which would mean according to families. Now, Jesus has been teaching and healing all day long, and the children were there. I'm not going to put too much time on that one. They didn't send the children off to be watched somewhere else. The children were in the time period where Jesus is teaching and healing all day long, and the children were there. I'll keep moving. But the other thing is these groups of 50s and 100, it creates aisles. You group these people. Now you can get in between the people, and Jesus knows what he's going to do to distribute this food, this bread and this fish. And again, it says that there was much grass in the place. You can go online and look at that if you want, okay? But it tells us that's probably comfortable. I mean, anybody outside yesterday out on your nice green grass when the rain finally stopped and after all this cooler weather, it was nice, okay? And then Jesus took the loaves, and having given thanks, now I'm going to take that word given thanks for a minute, often referred in the other Gospels, the word blessed. It is the word where we get the word Eucharist. This Greek word means to bless. It doesn't mean communion. It means to bless. So when you sit down to bless your food, it's a Eucharist. Okay, no matter what Catholicism labels the Eucharist, the reason they call it that is because when Jesus broke the bread at the Lord's Supper, he did this same thing. He gave thanks. Okay. So imagine he gave thanks for the five loaves and the two fishies. We tend to have a little sarcasm in our brain there. We'd be going, you're thanking him for that? That ain't going to get it. Do you know what I'm saying? I know you would never think that way. You're more spiritual than I am, but I would think that way. Okay? So he gives them thanks for what they had, but he's also thanking him in advance for the miracle. Jesus already knew what he intended to do. Okay? Let me put it another way. Present your prayers and supplications and petitions with thanksgiving. Okay? With. And you've heard me talk. Not and. With thanksgiving. So Jesus is coming. He knows what he's going to do. And he gives thanks ahead of time. We see Jesus do this on other occasions. We see him do it the Lord's Supper. And one of the reasons of the tradition in many Christian homes is to pray for food. Because Jesus did. We find it. He just did it. So we do it. Okay? In thanksgiving. Now Matthew Mark says he actually looked up to heaven. Now why do you think he would do that? Because 25,000 people are watching. Okay? He wants them to understand the source. I only do what the Father does. I and the Father are one. So let's look up where they know the Father to be. And let's make sure they understand that I'm doing this because the Father does it. All right? What's interesting, this is how John speaks of it later when they return to the same place. In verse 23, John says this, the place where they ate bread after the Lord had given thanks. The point he's pointing out, not the bread, the fish, not the lad, not the amount of people. But he recalls, this is the place where Jesus gave thanks. Okay, so the emphasis here is the giving thanks. That's the emphasis, at least in John's eyes. Okay? And he raises his eyes up to heaven. And what's interesting, again, he does the same thing when he raises Lazarus from the dead in John 11. Father, I thank you. That's how he starts. That you have already heard me. Well, you haven't said anything until here, until Lazarus. I mean, until he gets there, he doesn't say anything. That you've heard me. But I know that you always hear me. But for the sake of those standing here, I declare, Lazarus, come forth. He thanks God for the miracle before it's there. He does the same pattern here. Okay, so the crowd could see this, and again, I want to point out, it's the only miracle of Jesus recorded in all four Gospels. Why? Because it has 20 to 25,000 witnesses. You heal a guy by a pool, you have those in the room. You heal the official son, which we've already said, okay. Now, the official son, he heals with a word. It's done. But it isn't really much different when he comes to the man at the pool. Get up and walk. And his other miracle shown in the wedding at Cana, gee, don't touch it. Nothing. He just tells the guys to fill the jars. So the miracle sort of kind of happens in the hands of the servants that are obedient. Here, the miracle happens in the hands of Jesus. And he wants 20,000 witnesses. What's interesting to me is you read about Jesus' opponents, those who oppose Jesus. They never deny that his miracles are real. They never claim you do false things. Now, they didn't like what he said about he and the Father being one. But they never said, you know, he never healed that guy. Nope, he never fed 5,000. No. Why? Because there were too many people that were eyewitnesses to it. Easy. Did you hear he fed 5,000? Nah. We can just prove that. Ask one of the 5,000 men. Ask one of the 20,000 people there. They didn't do that. No, ask them. There are 20,000 or more eyewitnesses to it happening in Jesus' hand. You can't say it was the servants. You can't say it happened back at the official's home. You can't say it was because the guy's been laying there lame all this time and he was faking it. This happens in Jesus' hands where he creates something that never existed before. Okay? And he distributed to those who were seated, likewise the fish. Casual statement. No fanfare. No setup. And he doesn't use that language to prime the crowd to receive their miracle. No. He doesn't even address them. He just prays for the food and starts. Now, here it doesn't tell us, but the other Gospels, he distributed via the disciples. Okay? And remember, don't just think 12, because you're going to think, man, them 12 is going to take a long time to hand out all that food. Well, there's more than 12 here that are referred to as disciples in general. Okay? So in Luke tells us he broke those pieces of bread, of course, and gave it to disciples and set it before the crowd. So he's going to break the fish too, I'm assuming, right? But I want you to think about here he's got he gets down to the last of the five loaves and takes that piece and puts it in the hand or the basket or whatever one of the disciples is carrying. Probably they've got the robe, part of the robe up like this, and you're putting it in there. I hope it's clean. But anyway, putting it in there, all right? But then there's more bread. Where'd that come from? Didn't he just give out the last piece? Okay, he is creating bread, not from grain that grew in the ground, but grain that never touched the earth. That flour that bread meant never, no person ever ground into flour. Fish that never swam in the sea. Using Jesus' terms later, that's bread and fish from heaven. Bread and fish not affected by the fall. Entropy, the decay, they begin to break down. The wheat of Jesus' day, like our wheat today, not the same as the wheat that would have been grown in the Garden of Eden. What does wheat and fish taste like that's never seen imperfection? No wonder they ate till they were full. Went back home. No, you wouldn't believe. No, really, this is the best fish I ever. No, you've never tasted fish like this, Kylie. No, you never. And the bread, you couldn't even tell it was barley. All right. Now, I'm exaggerating there a bit to make a point, though. He creates something that's never seen the physical realm in front of 20 to 25,000 people. I don't know if you know this, but one of the things he's showing you is he's greater than Elisha. Because Elisha fed 100 people on 20 loaves of barley bread and had some left over. 2 Kings 4. All right? You thought Elijah was one of those prophets of which they be speaking with Philip talked about that they'll refer to here. Jesus is greater than even Elisha. Okay? Who did double the miracles of Elijah? Jesus is greater than that. You thought feeding 100 guys with 20 loaves. But if that was a miracle, 100 with 20 loaves, imagine the miracle of 20,000 on 5 loaves. And it says they had as much as they wanted. I'm going to contrast that to even if we bought a bunch, did everybody have a little? He wants to make point out, he wants to understand this impossible thing went beyond just supplying some. All they wanted, and they were filled. Not just enough to be polite, but they were filled. They wanted to sit back in the recliner, put their slippers on, and loosen their belt. Trying to put it in a good old Western gluttony form, okay? And then he says to the disciples, gather up the leftover fragments. Jesus knew this. When God supplied, there was more than enough.
Now, please don't think finances right now. Think grace.
More than enough. God has enough grace. There's some left over. You don't get to use it up. You can't use it up. It's infinite. As God is infinite, so is His grace. Yeah, when the devil's trying to tell you, you used up God's grace, slap him up the head, side the head, and call him a liar. Then Jesus gives the reason, he says, why he wants them to go to collect this. So that. Now, I think most of us are pretty good students of English. Enough to know when you say so that, he's telling you why. So that nothing will be lost. This is important. Jesus uses the same general phrase later in the chapter, I will lose none. I know, you've never made that connection. Let me read to you from the Didache. The Didache is a Greek document from before, still in the first century. It was written, they believe, to some outlying churches that hadn't had an apostle come and teach them the things. And it's a letter of instruction. You can go look at it online. They have it, okay, in English for you, okay. In chapter 9, section 4. We thank you, our Father, there's the Eucharist part, the blessing, for the life and the knowledge which you have made known to us through your servant, to you be glory forever. Even as the broken bread was scattered over the hills and was gathered together and became one, so let your church be gathered together from the ends of the earth into your kingdom, for yours is the glory and the power through Jesus Christ. Let me put it this way. This early author in the first century, writing to a church in the island, sees this imagery of the bread being broken and cast out as the church. And I want you to make sure, Jesus says, that none of it is lost. I'm making a leap here, and I know some of you are going, what? You will see Jesus himself makes that statement of the church. None will be lost. Remember, this is to test them. He's setting them up for what's to come. It's not about the fish spoiling or the bread getting moldy. The 12 baskets, to show you the extent of the miracle. How big were those baskets? I don't know. It's not the point. Verse 13. So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments from the 5 barley loaves, which was left over by those who had eaten. It's simply to underscore the greatness of this miracle. How in the world did 5 loaves and 2 fish become 12 baskets full? It wasn't, it was created on the spot. Okay? Jesus is the creator. Remember his claim in the previous chapter, I and the Father are one. I do what the Father does. The Father creates, watch me. Therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, this is truly the prophet who is to come. For one, I'm going to grab hold of the word sign because it's one John uses a lot. Okay, and remember, he's giving 7 signs to prove that Jesus is the Son of God or God, as we found out in chapter 5. When you say that, you're claiming to be God. That's why they wanted to kill him. But it also refers back to Deuteronomy 18 and 15, and the Lord Moses speaking, and the Lord God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. As long as he doesn't come from Nazareth, we'll be all right with that, right? He needs to come anyway. All right. So they recognize that. This is what the prophets, in particular Moses, being Passover season, particularly the one he spoke of. This is that prophet. Remember what the woman at the well said. I perceive that you are a prophet. Okay. So Jesus, perceiving, they haven't said anything. He reads their minds. perceiving that they were intended to come take him by force and make him king. How do you do that? I'm not sure. Okay. He withdrew again to the mountain. So they're down there collecting. He goes further up the mountain. If you, again, you can go look at this. Look, it's, I don't know what, I forget to look at the elevation of it, but you can do 360 from that area. Look over into Jordan. You can look all the way. He goes up on the mountain further. And we'll learn next time about what happens to the disciples in this process. Okay. What's interesting is he didn't have a problem when Nathanael hailed him as the king of Israel in chapter 1. That's how Nathanael recognized him after Philip had introduced him as the one which Moses and the prophets wrote. Nathanael meets him when Jesus sees him. Before he even gets there, he sees him under the tree, the king of Israel. Okay. But what's interesting, I think Jesus' biggest struggle with the crowd, according to what he says in verse 26, "You seek me," he says later, "not because you saw the sign, but because you wanted a handout, because you ate some of the loaves and were filled." I'm retreating here because you don't want to vote for me as king because of who I am. You want to vote for me as king because what you think I'm going to give you. That's what Jesus said. Yeah, you want a king and wants to give you handouts. Raise the government check you're getting, if the analogy for us. The only reason you want to follow me is because you think if you follow me, you can be prosperous, happy, well-fed. I think one of the lessons we can draw from this is we ought not to seek Christ for what he can do for us in this world. There is a whole movement in so-called Christianity. It's all about that. Jesus came to do stuff for you so you can have stuff. Okay? You can have your best life now. Okay? Matter of fact, he was creative and you speak the right words. You can create your own prosperity. Okay? Jesus says, excuse me, I'm moving up the mountain. I'm going to put it this way. There is no presence of God in that crowd. That modern crowd that's saying this. It's about what you can give me. God says, I retreat from there. I pull away from that. I'm not in that. Rather, we should seek God for what he has already done. If he never gives you a piece of barley bread, if he never offers you a piece of pickled fish, in our story today, he's already done everything you would ever need. He's already, through the cross and his substitutionary death there, took our punishment that we would have eternity with him. He decided who gets to hang with him. And of those, he'll lose none, by the way. He did it already. What else can you ask him for? That's why if you start with thanksgiving, start with thanksgiving of this. Father, I thank you for the cross of our Christ. I thank you that he took my sin and bore my iniquity. Then what are you going to ask for after that? Well, you know what? Because I come that way, he says, you know what? If just ask according to my will and it's done. Notice according to his will. Okay? But I think it puts it in perspective when we're not looking for God to do something for us. If we look to God for what he's already done. Remember those testimonies, those proofs of who he is. This is one of them, this story. And I'll take you back to verse 36 of chapter 5. But the testimony which I have, Jesus, is greater than the testimony of John. For the works, this is one of his works, which the Father has given me to accomplish, the works that I do testify about me that the Father has sent me. No, this ain't here to testify how you can get a free meal. This is done that you would understand this crowd, that I am sent from the Father. What does that mean? Well, we learn the religious people say, we're going to kill you because you claim to be God. It's there to tell you he is God, not to tell you how to get a handout. And there were plenty of people that followed him. And we find out in the same chapter when Jesus started getting rough with the words, they leave. Oh, this ain't about bread and fish. This isn't about what I can get from this. This means I have to do so. I don't like that. I just want to know what you will do for me. And they abandon. Our Western culture looks to religion, even in evangelism, we tend to do this. You have this empty void. Jesus will come fill your void and you'll feel better. We even approach the gospel that way. You know, I know your life's a mess. Give it to Jesus, it'll be better. You sure? Are you sure about that? I'll take you other places in the world that gave their lives to Christ and it ain't better. Matter of fact, they're persecuted, killed, all kinds of reasons. They didn't get any better. They were doing fine until they switched from Islam to Christianity. Then things went bad. So it's not that your life becomes better, that there's more loaves and more fish. It gets better in this sense. There's a life yet to come. And it ain't about this one. And in this one, I'll follow him even to a cross, which does lead to an empty tomb, though, too. But he guarantees you this. In this world, you will have tribulation. I guarantee it. That's a promise. Put that on your refrigerator up there. Okay, with your Joshua 1:9. And I know the plans I have for you out of Jeremiah 29:11. You will have tribulation. But I have overcome this world. Which means what? It's all about the world to come. Don't look for him what he's going to do for you now. Look for what he's already done in time. So therefore, that's accomplished and you've seen what's done outside of time. Let's stand. Lord, I thank you for these miracles, these stories in your word that sort of boggle our mind. We're sort of overwhelmed with the measure of it, the size of it. God, but I thank you in that you show who you are. You show, God, that it isn't about those things, but it's about what you came to do, to save us from our sin, to take our place, to show and reveal to us God. We thank you, O Lord, that when we see Christ, we see you, not ourselves, but you, Almighty God. To you be the praise and the glory. Amen.
This is Stephen Wilson, and we want to thank you for joining us today, and we hope you were blessed by today's message. Truths from God's Unchanging Word is an outreach ministry of Kindred Bible Church in Caldwell, Idaho. If you would like to listen to other messages by Pastor Randy or learn more about Kindred Bible Church, visit kindredbible.org. Our prayer for you is that you grow closer to Christ as we study the truths from God's unchanging word.